And welcome to the worldwide broadcast of the Ted and Austin Brewer Show, bringing you the latest world news and health research. Good to be with you today. It's a beautiful Friday down here in Central Florida. We're just a few days away from Election Day. A few stories that I want to cover with you. We're going to bring my good friend, Dr. Mark Rutland, on in just a few minutes. But let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the Democratic Party right now. This is some crazy stuff. Again, they wanted to rebrand themselves and call themselves socialists, and they've done a good job of that. And now Andrew Gillum is continuing to be exposed by his staff in an undercover video. I talked briefly about this yesterday. Florida gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum, the current mayor of Tallahassee, who has basically caused Tallahassee to become one of the most crime-ridden cities in the state, who is the person of interest in a corruption investigation by the FBI, is the subject of a new undercover video from Project Veritas that shows his campaign staffers saying that he changes his message to appear moderate when it benefits him politically, even though he's really a far-left progressive. Omar Smith, a staffer for Gillum, said that the candidate is a progressive and part of the crazies who will not be able to deliver on campaign promises such as gun control because Florida is a cracker white state. Gillum reportedly will be unable to deliver on his campaign promise, including Medicare for All. He said that it is necessary for Gillum to appeal to white guilt to win, and once in, he will try to replace the Republican legislature. Update, Andrew Gillum has denied that the man featured in Project Veritas video was on his staff, but was a contractor, and that he has severed ties with him. I guess he has said too many things that cannot be substantiated. Yesterday, I had reported, because another story had come out concerning this, that Gillum had used the word cracker. Apparently, I was incorrect and got bad information on that. Apparently, it was the staffer who had used the word cracker, but of course Gillum is doing his best to distance himself from all of this stuff. By the way, a UN leaked memo now has revealed that Saudi Arabia has paid $1 billion to the UN and demanded favorable propaganda about its war on Yemen in exchange. As a leaked internal United Nations document detailing $930 million pay-to-play scheme orchestrated by Saudi Arabia exposed a demand by the Saudis that the UN humanitarian groups in Yemen, including the UN Development Program OCHA, the World Health Organization, and UNICEF, provide favorable publicity. Thus, the nearly $1 billion was essentially hush money for the sake of propaganda, meant to shield the kingdom from scrutiny over its war in Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands, which was previously described by the UN as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, as it has pushed millions to the brink of starvation. Guys, this thing in Yemen is getting much, much worse, and they simply don't want to talk about it in the name mainstream media. By the way, speaking of the media, the left-wing media elevates migrants while insulting Americans. Liberal journalists are lying about the admitted criminals in the caravan. Sources at the border report that the caravan is 70% single men, and Mexico's own ambassador said in an NPR interview that many are very violent. However, the leftist media is lying to Americans about the caravan not being dangerous while denigrating their own countrymen. The left needs immigrant voters because they cannot win elections based on their ideas and philosophy. An article in the New York Times advocated for replacing the embittered white conservative minority. I'm going to repeat that. They're calling us the embittered white conservative minority. One of the men in the caravan admitted he was charged with a third-degree felony of attempted murder. Mexican authorities arrested two young Honduran men on charges of shooting at federal police officers who were escorting the caravan. I have no idea why they're being escorted. Another incident involved men from Central America who sets fires in an immigration facility in Mexico in an attempt to escape from being deported. Mexican authorities are reporting the use of firearms and Molotov cocktails by the migrants. Reporters have noted that members of the brutal MS-13 gang are also heavily embedded in the caravan. This is getting crazy, guys. By the way, CNN's Don Lemon says that white men are the biggest terror threat in America while downplaying left-wing violence. By the way, Lemon is a gay, openly gay reporter on CNN, and he has a white boyfriend, if you guys want to just hold off on the gag section here for a second. CNN news section, this anchor, Don Lemon, says the biggest terror threat in the country is white men. I guess one of his boyfriend could be one of them. Most of them radicalized to the right, and we have to start doing something about them. He questioned why there is no travel ban on white guys. I mean, this is nuts. Lemon also said he doesn't see Democrats killing people over politics. He hasn't been looking very closely, which caught the attention of Republican Representative Steve Scalise, who was literally shot and seriously wounded by far-left Bernie Sanders supporter who fired off more than 200 rounds in an attempted mass murder last year. Guys, you know, the whole thing about this is crazy. I mean, when you have all of these groups of people hating up on white people, basically praising the left, praising communism, praising socialism. It's getting really, really, really bad. In fact, Trump now is sending thousands of troops to the border. The first 100 have already arrived, and they're setting up tents right now. Other reporters have also said and come in and said that they're going to be bringing in all types of heavy artillery. Now, whether that's true or not, I've not been able to vet that information. But guys, this could be a major, major skirmish on the border. And it's like my guest yesterday, J.P. Wells, said, J.P. Wells, you know, the president of the United States has the right to defend the borders of the United States against invasion, and he is exercising his executive authority to do that. So it's just, this is absolutely nuts that this is going on in the border, and that we're continuing to have to report on this stuff, and that the media is pushing this so they can promote their left politics. Donald Trump says the word racist is used to describe every Republican that is winning. President Donald Trump defied charges Thursday from Democrats and the establishment media that he was a racist for supporting tough measures on immigration enforcement. He's also has already been called an anti-Semite. So nowadays, you know, Donald Trump is one of the most pro-Israel presidents we've ever had. In fact, he's moved the American embassy from Tel Aviv into Jerusalem, and basically loves to support Israel. And so now he's an anti-Semite who's also a racist. It's what they do. They always try to call people names as either an anti-Semite or a racist, simply what they always want to do. He goes on to say, well, you know, the word racist is used about every Republican that's winning, Trump said in an interview with Christian Broadcast Network CBN. At any time a Republican is leading, they take out the R word and they use the racist word. Trump denied that he was an anti-immigrant, asserting that the country needed them, but that all immigrants had to come into the country legally. I am absolutely in agreement with Trump on this. I am not anti-immigration at all. I'm for people from coming into this country legally and people based on merit, he said. The president, who announced that he would no longer continue the practice of catch and release for immigrants claiming asylum at the southern border, we're going to catch and we're not going to release. They're going to stay with us until the deportation hearing or the asylum hearing takes place, Trump said in a speech at the White House earlier this week. Guys, this is some crazy stuff that's actually happening right now on our borders. And guys, it's going to be something that we're going to see play out right before the midterm elections, which was perfectly calculated and I believe orchestrated by the left through George Soros, through all the organizations that he is funding. And like I've said so many times on this show, who is supporting these people, these tens of thousands of people, who's feeding them, who's clothing them, who's giving them shelter, who's giving them bathroom facilities. Something is going on down here that we're unaware of, and I guarantee you guys, it's going to be all catching itself right at this election cycle. So pray that the Republicans and the conservatives sweep all of these elections, and all of the stuff that these guys are doing backfires on them. That's one of my goals. In fact, it's also one of the goals of my next guest, Dr. Mark Rutland, who's been a friend of mine for many, many years, 14, 15 years now, former head president of Southeastern University and Oral Roberts University, author of many books, has sold millions of books, one of the top platform speakers in the world, also has a company and a ministry called Global Servants, and has been a good friend of mine for many years. In fact, it's going to be his birthday here in a couple of days on November the 5th, so I'm so happy to bring him onto the show. I've been trying to get him on for a long time, and his schedule is so busy. So, Dr. Mark Rutland, my pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for being the man that you are. How do you want to start your interview, Pastor? What would you like to ask me?
Thank you, Ted. It's so nice to be with you. I really, really appreciate it. It's something I've been looking forward to for a long time. We share so many values. This horrible business on the southern border is just a travesty, and it's frightening. I have a good friend whose son is an MP, and he just arrived on the border yesterday, and was shipped down there yesterday, and I think he arrived today. And you know, this, you don't know what's going to happen there. You don't know who on the other side of the border is armed. We don't know who these people are. We don't even know if they're all even Latinos. You know, for all we know, they're Middle Easterners. There's anybody. You have thousands of people there, and you just can't allow that to just pour across the border unchecked and unvetted in any way. It's really a dangerous travesty.
It really is, and that's why I want to have you on, because I want to talk a little bit about that. Also, you've lived a bit of an adventure. I mean, I've listened to you speak so many times. In fact, I've traveled all over the place to hear you speak, because you're one of my favorite speakers in the world. And you've had quite a bit of adventure. You've lived in the jungles of South America. You've been in remote villages in Africa. You've preached and you taught in every inhabited continent. How did that happen? And Pastor, what motivates for you to do that and to go that way and to spend your life doing these things?
It really has been an adventure. I wish I could convince young people that serving God faithfully is an adventure that makes circumnavigating the globe look like a Boy Scout hike. It's just so exciting. Every new chapter that God opens in your life, you don't know what's going to happen next or where it will lead or any of it. And it really has been an adventure. I've been held at gunpoint in an African airport. I was turned back at the time of a counter coup. I've lived with Indians on the edge of the Stone Age, so deep in the Peruvian jungle that at times we weren't even sure what country we were in. And that was at a time, Ted, when it was very, very dangerous down there. It still is, of course. But the communist guerrillas down there, the Sendero Luminosos, you remember they were called the Shining Path.
That's
and
right.
They were some of the most dangerous communist guerrillas in the world. They were operating in that same jungle. The droguistas were there. And, of course, the only thing more dangerous than the droguistas were the Peruvian police. And so it was just a scary time. And yet it was a great time. And I just your question is a good one. How did it happen? Really, it just happened one chapter at a time. You just go through the next door. And it opens onto a wider adventure, and then another one, and another one. People said to me all the time, "Your dreams have all come true." I said, "We've gone way past anything I ever dreamed." it's been an adventure.
You've got a couple of stories, and I should have covered these with you before we did the show today, because I know you remember them. I want to make sure I'm not going to try to butcher them. I remember one time you were like working with a guy, and I remember you told us this story a few years ago when we were at your convention up in Atlanta about how you were under this big kapok tree or this big tree, and you were preaching, and somebody had Lord spoke to speak to him, and then something else happened to somebody getting out of a canoe one time, and then you had the story about the guys in Thailand, the German nationals that were trying to sell you a young girl as a virgin and told you that the police were on their side. Go over all those stories with us, because these are some really, really interesting things that have happened to you that I think my listeners will really enjoy learning about if you know what I'm talking about. I hope I didn't butcher them too bad. Go ahead, Pastor.
No, sure, of course. Well, I will say this. I was in my house in the United States. I'd never been to Ghana, West Africa. And really, I'm always a little reluctant to use high-blown spiritual language like a vision, but I had an experience where I saw in my mind, in my mind's eye, if you will, me standing at the roots of a huge tree, and there was an African man standing beside me translating, and I was speaking to an African audience. I then went to Ghana for the first trip, and didn't know anybody, didn't know one thing. I just knew the Lord said, buy a ticket, go to Ghana. I got down at, it was a nightmare. I was robbed in the airport at gunpoint. It was, everybody had stolen the lights out of the airport, Kotoka Airport in 1981. It was
crazy.
I was in the country. They took the Supreme Court out in a field and machine gunned them while I was there. Everybody had to stay in their house. But then this man came to the house where I was staying. I had finally met somebody who was staying at their house, and he said, would I come out to this village and preach? And I went down with him to this village, and we walked down a pathway into a cocoa grove. And he said, these people have been waiting for you for 3 hours. Just go up, stand up, and preach. I stepped up to the roots of this tree, and another man stepped up and stood beside me, and he said, I'm your translator. And it was the very man I saw in my experience in my house.
Wow.
I could hardly talk. I could hardly even talk. It was so overwhelming. And that man has been our national director in West Africa. He's our West African director. He's been our West African director now for more than 30 years. Really a great, great man of God. And we were introduced in my house before I ever saw Africa. It was really a miracle. Hmm. The story in the boat in Peru, we were going up to visit a tribe that a man had come down to us there was one tribe deep in the jungle. Nobody even knew this group, and we were going to go up there. The chief was sick, and he came and said, we know that you're missionaries, you have some medicine, and would you come? Well, it was dicey because if he gets well, then everything's good. If he dies, they might blame you. And so we prayed about it and we decided to go. And I sent Carlos Guzman into town to get some petrol for the motor. We had a little canoe and a Evinrude motor. And I said, get some tins of tuna fish. We used tuna fish as gifts for the Indian villages because they would spend so much of their lives trying to get fish out of those rivers that just to pop a Bowie knife in the top of a can and pull out clean fish was a miracle to them. So we went 12 hours upriver, Ted. It was excruciating. And perched in a little tiny canoe, we finally were in a river that was only about 15 feet wide, 20 feet wide, and we saw Indians on the bank with bows and arrows and war paint. And I told Carlos, I said, get the tuna fish ready. I want to hand out the gifts the minute we land, the minute the canoe hits the beach. And he said, oh, I forgot the tuna fish.
Oh, no.
I said, Carlos, you may have gotten us killed. How could you do this? And, you know, I didn't handle it very well. I was really upset. I was frightened. And then, you know, you try to say something religious just to cover the situation. And I said, all right, we'll just have to trust God. And everybody in the canoe was quiet, you know. And we didn't go 50 yards up that river, Ted, and a huge fish jumped out of the river and landed in the canoe. And God really spoke to me in that canoe. And he said, look, I made this jungle. I made these Indians. I made this river. And the fish leap at my command.
Wow.
All I'm asking you to do is keep the canoe upriver. I do everything else. And it was really two of the great, great, great spiritual experiences in my life.
I remember that. And I think I asked you personally, I said, what happened to the guy who was sick? Did he recover? I mean, what happened with him?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, he did recover. And he became a Christian. And there is actually, we built a church in that village and two more in the area. So we actually built three churches in that area where there were no churches, no Christians when we got there. So it was really a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Now you also have a girl's home, a big girl's home in Thailand. Yeah. And I've seen the pictures. I've talked to the girls that were there. We had a lot of them come to the convention you had with us a few years ago, and it was a real blessing. Tell me what you do with these girls, why you've done this with the girls, and tell me that experience when that German national came up to you in your room and knocked on your door.
All right. The first time I went to Thailand, I was not had in my mind in any way to start a girls' home. We weren't interested in that side of work. It wasn't something. I mean, I approve of it. I think it's great. I just said it's not what God has called me to do. But my first night there, I had to fly into Bangkok and stay at the airport hotel and then fly the next day to Chiang Rai where we were going to do the crusade and do the ministry. That night, it wasn't a German national. Actually, he thought I was a German.
Oh, so okay, okay.
He came to my room. A Thai man came to my room with a little girl. Maybe 11, maybe 10, something like this, a child. And he knocked on the door, spoke to me in German, and I just answered him and said, "Nein, ich bin ein Amerikaner. I'm an American. Ich spreche Sie Deutsch." So he switched to English, and his English was excellent. He said, "That's good. My English is better than my German." He said, "There's Germans in the hotel, so I thought you were a German." And he said, "I bought this girl this afternoon in a village," and he said, "I got a doctor, and he has certified that she's a virgin." And he said, "You give me $400, you take her in your room, you do whatever you want to, you have her all night, and I'll come back and collect her in the morning." And I was horrified. I was just stunned. I had two daughters of my own that were about the same age back in the U.S. And I said, "I'm calling the police. I'm calling the cops. You can't do this." And he laughed in my face. He said, "You're the foreigner here." He said, "This is my country."
Wow.
He said, "You don't call the police. I call the police." He said, "I can have you arrested. I can have you charged." And he said, "I can reach you in prison. I can have you killed in prison." And he put his hands on my chest and he shoved me back in my room violently. And he said, "Now go back in your room, Farang," means foreigner, outsider. go back in your room, Farang, and shut your mouth. He said, I'll sell this girl before I get to the end of the hall, and there's nothing you can do about it. And I was confused. I couldn't think of what to do. I thought he was probably right. He could have me arrested and charged with what he was doing. And I was confused. And I paced up and down for a while, and then I decided I was just going to run. I don't know what I thought I was going to do, Ted. I guess rush in the hall like Jackie Chan and grab her or something. I don't know. But when I opened the door, he was gone, and I've never seen that child again. The next morning, I sat with a Thai pastor, and I told him what had happened, and he was a little bit blasé, to tell you the truth. He said, well, we have a major problem. This is 1986. I guess everybody knows about child sex trafficking now. I did not in 1986. I guess it's kind of a hot button now, but at that time, I didn't realize it. And he said, well, it's a big problem. Thailand is at the epicenter of child sex trafficking. But he was not, I don't know, he seemed, you know, sort of business as usual about it. And I'm my American self-righteousness. I said, somebody ought to do something. You just sit there talking about this. Somebody should do something. And he took it for a little while. And then he pointed his finger in my chest and he said, you're somebody. Aren't you somebody? And it hit me like a hammer in the head. I couldn't get away from it. I couldn't quit thinking about it. On the plane all the way home, when I thought about that child and all she had gone through, I started crying. I told my wife about it. She started crying. We went back to Thailand in 1986. We started House of Grace. And it's been an unbelievable story. We have 120 girls. We have 14 buildings on two campuses. We have another House of Grace in West Africa. We're about to launch a third one. We're investigating doing one in Thailand. It's in Haiti. It's just been an incredible story that began from one single question. He said, aren't you somebody? And it changed the direction of our ministry.
Well, you know, you said something at the conference which really, really touched me. You said that you've learned that so many of the girls get into the sex slave business at such a young age. And once they're in it, they pretty much can't be taken out of it. It just simply doesn't work. You can't get them out. So what you do is you go into the villages and you get the parents to give you the daughters before they go into the sex slave areas. Tell us about that.
Yes. Thank you. I love to hear it when somebody was really listening. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I believe in rescuing girls from the sex trade. I believe in bringing them out, trying to teach them a new life, everything else. But, Ted, think. From the time you're 10, 11, 12 years old for 3 or 4 years, you service 6 or 8 clients a night for 3 or 4 years, your mind and body and life are wrecked up no matter what you do. And I just thought interdiction is a better way. Why not do something before they're caught in the trade? So we actually go to the villages in the north, Akka villages. We were doing both Akka and Hmong girls, but now we work only with Akkas. And we have what we call an at-risk portrait, an orphan girl, a girl that's been shuffled around from family to family, somebody that's uncared for, whatever. And I've never bought a girl. I don't do that. That seems to me that's taking part in the trade I'm trying to stop. So we go to the head man of the village or to whoever's in charge of the girl, and we make a straight out economic argument. I don't deal with ethics or morality or religion or anything. I say, you give us the girl and we will guarantee she'll make more money for you over her lifetime than she would make in a brothel or a bar in Bangkok, and she will not die with AIDS. And you give us the girl and I guarantee you. And we've even had the government of Thailand bring us girls. Now this is a Buddhist government. Then we found one little girl living in the market in Chiang Rai. She was living like a little animal behind the vegetable stands. So at the end of the day, when the vegetable and fruit and all was no good, they throw it over the wall into an alley, and she was living back there eating it. And so we bring them in. We house them, feed them, clothe them. We do everything. And I make this deal with them. Any school you can get into in Thailand, now I'm not paying to send one to Harvard, But any school you can get into in Thailand, if it's a trade school or medical school, I'll pay every penny of it. And we've now brought hundreds of girls through college, university, trade schools. We have three attorneys, nurses, teachers. One is a missionary in China. The last time I was there, my wife and I had dinner with one of our alumni, and she's an attorney and an international practicing in an international law firm. She was the lead attorney in a lawsuit with an American tractor company. It was it's really amazing what guys. We have hundreds and hundreds of alumni now who are trained, educated, equipped. Some are not clever. They don't do well in school, so we help them become, you know, maybe small-time merchants or something. But a proper job, a real life, and not being drifted into the bars and the brothels.
You know, Pastor, I've been to Thailand, and I walked down the brothel area of the street. I guess you would call it the red light district.
Yeah,
because I wanted to see. See for myself. This is in Bangkok, and I wanted to see for myself if it was real. Sharon was with me. I had another friend that was with me, and I was shocked at how young the girls were soliciting people to come into the bars. I'm talking 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, and it was one of the – how should I say this? One of the worst experiences of my adult life, because I did not know how bad the sex slave industry was, particularly in Thailand, and how many people, including the German nationals and United States people, go over there because they're pedophiles and they want to have sex with these young girls. And it grieved my spirit so much. And then when I found out about you guys and what you're doing, that's why I've supported you guys so heavily over the years, because I know that you're making a difference in Thailand. And guys, my listeners, listen to me for a second. You guys are always sending me emails. You're always sending me questions. You're always sending me texts. And you say, look, should I support TV ministers? My response is always this: keep your money in the local church, with the exception of Mark Rutland or Global Servants. This is the man that I personally support. I can't tell you how my endorsement, how deep it runs. I mean, I literally call him up every November the 5th for his birthday for the past 10 or 15 years, just to tell him, you know, that we appreciate him. Because I know that this man's making a difference. So, guys, we're going to give you some information in a few minutes. Now, you've never heard me do this with another ministry before on this show. Never. I'm going to give you information, and I want you to support this ministry. I want you to support Global Service. I don't care if you give a dollar, $5, $10, $100, or $10,000. I want this to be a routine part of what you do. A lot of you are looking for churches. A lot of you say, well, I don't like my local church. The pastor's progressive, and I don't like what he's doing. Okay, I'm not going to that church anymore. Mark Rutland is always speaking somewhere. He's got a lot of YouTube videos. He always has a really good schedule. You can get that off of Global Servant's website, and you can listen to him many times online. He's one of the best speakers you're ever going to hear, and this is where I plant a lot of my seed, because, guys, listen to me for a second. You know, it doesn't matter how much seed you sow if you sow it in the bad soil. There's a lot of nonprofit organizations out there that are really bad soil. I'm not going to name any names because I don't do that. You guys know that. Mark Rutland is about as fertile a soil as you're going to get. And we haven't even started talking about Africa yet and what he's doing in Africa. So in a few minutes, I'm going to give you the information on Global Service. I want you guys to write it down. I want you to start supporting Mark. And now, guys, you've been with me for many years now, and you've never heard me not once endorse a ministry like this for your support. So, guys, stay tuned. I've got a lot more to come. Now, tell me, Mark, about what's going on in Africa and what you're doing there in the villages. Tell me about the pit latrines that you're building and how the Muslims won't let the people use the bathrooms unless they convert to Muslim. I want to hear it all on the show today.
Thank you, Ted. Yes, we've been working in West Africa longer than we've been in Thailand. We started there, as I told you, in 1981 through that miraculous trip. We've done a lot of different things, everything from – I've preached in prisons and jails all over the country. We started the prison chaplaincy program there, and then village of church planting, little villages where there was no Christian presence. Not everybody wants to build a huge church in a major metropolitan area, which is good, and I approve of that. But we really felt led to go to these little remote, primitive villages. We built 35 churches in 5 countries. And there's a lot in the northern, as you get closer to the Sahara Desert, there's a lot of Islamic presence and even persecution. One of our churches in Burkina Faso was knocked over and we had to rebuild it, and some things like that. But some of the Islamic villages, they won't let the Christian people use the toilets. And in some villages, there is no toilets. And it's a huge problem of disease and danger, especially for a woman who has to go out in the bush at night, you can imagine. and not just being molested or raped, but also snake bite is a terrible problem. And so we went to around all these villages and asked, what can we do? What do you want most? And they said, facilities, toilets. So we build it's an upscale version of an outhouse is what it is, with a structure, four doors, places, that kind of thing. And it's very solid. It'll last about 10 years. And we're building them all over these villages in West Africa. We've built several hundred now, and it's pathetic. It's so moving, Ted, to have this village. You know, it's not like you built them a library or a movie theater. It's a bank of toilets, four toilets, and they have a ribbon cutting ceremony, and they're just coming out and thanking you because it's the only toilet in the village, or it's the only ones the Christians can use. And it's really been a humbling experience. That's caring for people's most basic needs, and there's no glory in it. There's just no glory in building toilets. But no, there's not that.
Explain to my audience about how the Muslims use the toilets in the facilities to force people to convert to become Muslims.
Yeah, they're in certain villages. They would say if you want to use the toilets, then you have to convert. So it is a forced conversion in that sense. But we have done the opposite. The toilets that we build in the villages are under the control of the local pastor, but he says these are not just for Christians. So it works the other way. We let the Muslims can use those toilets, but the Christians can't use the Muslim toilets. So it's making a tremendous statement. A tremendous statement. I've had Islamic. Our son really went there and has been ramrodding this project, and he said he's had Muslim village chiefs to say we just never dreamed of anything like this, and we don't have to thank you. And he says we do this because of Jesus Christ. That's why. And it's making a real statement. I never would have thought of it. Would you? So what are we going to do for all these villages? Build toilets? Right. It never occurred to me.
Well, I mean, you know, we don't think about that here in the West. And, you know, when we talk about the sub-Saharan Africa, groups of people from Somalia coming into Europe and coming into the United States, and they get to a toilet, they don't know what it is. They don't know how to flush it. They don't know how to open the doors. They don't know how to do a stall. And they're having problems in Europe now, especially in Germany, where the Muslims are coming in from Somalia and other parts of Europe and other parts of Africa, and they're just using the bathroom in the streets or in the bushes just like they did at home, and they think it's normal. And the people in Europe are freaking out, thinking, how come these guys can't use a toilet? But if you've never seen a toilet, you have no idea. I remember the first time I went to Europe with my dad back in the 70s, and I was shocked because a lot of the bathrooms you go into at that point, you know, 40 years ago, there was a hole in the floor. And that's all it was a hole. There wasn't a flushing toilet. There was a hole in the floor that you kind of had to perch over and hope you hit. And it was so weird to me to think, wow, how can Europe, as civilized as it's been for, you know, centuries, have holes in the floor instead of running toilets in the bathrooms? And see, this is a difference that a lot of people don't understand. When you start doing intercultural relations and intercultural travel, and you start seeing how other people live in third world countries, I think personally, Pastor, that everybody needs to go to a third world country at least once in their life, work with the local inhabitants, the indigenous people, and see what a difference it is. This is why we have 10,000-15,000 migrants coming in from Central and South America, coming in through Mexico, because they don't want to live like that anymore. They've heard too much of how great it is in the United States, how much money people make, and they're coming here. And quite frankly, if I was a migrant in South America or Central America and I couldn't get through with normal immigration protocol, I might be considering sneaking across the border too, just to get out of that misery, because the misery index is so high down there. So when you go into these countries like you're doing into Africa or into Thailand, and you help these people, it helps to get rid of that misery index, and it really helps to make these people feel as though that they're worthwhile individuals, especially in Thailand, where people are becoming lawyers and doctors or trades or running shops and not being put into the sex slave trade. Now, a few more things I want to talk about, because we've got about 20 minutes left. You've been the president of two universities. You spent years with American millennials, these little brats you call them. Okay. What are the challenges that we're facing with American millennials? And how can we get these kids to start to straighten up and not think that progressivism or socialism or communism is okay? How do we get the Protestant work ethic back into our country, Pastor? What do you think we should do?
You know, I spent 16 years surrounded by millennials, and I always joke around with them. I always say, I love you little brats. They laugh about it, but I do love them. They are a watershed generation, Ted. They're some of the best things in the world I see in the millennials. High energy, a high sense of morals. But sometimes their moral values are not informed. They want to do the right thing. They don't know how to think right sometimes. But they are very energetic. They're extremely creative. Their technological skills are over the moon. They're beyond anything we can think of. And they have all kinds of potential. The greatest downside in the millennial generation is one word. It's entitlement.
Right.
They just feel they've got it coming, and that they're basically entitled to everything, anything. And that is what socialism panders to. Socialism. Why would American millennials be in favor of socialism? It's because they think the message of socialism is you're entitled to this, you ought to have it, and the government will provide it. But they don't understand how socialism works. They don't understand the fundamentals of capitalism, and they do not, you are 100% right, they do not understand the concept of the good, solid work ethic. You work, you eat. You don't work, you don't eat. It's the greatest challenge that we face is to bring the millennial generation into a new appreciation for what capitalism means and for the work ethic and a sense of morals that is biblically informed, that's not emotional. Their moral stance is emotionally informed. In other words, it's, I know this is wrong because it makes me feel bad. You see what I'm saying? And so as a result, they can't make a clear ethical decision. They don't have a thought process, a framework to hang it on. They operate, they feel that their feelings are the same thing as their morals. If we can ever get them, this generation, to bypass their emotions and land on an ethical framework, they could be the greatest generation since World War II.
Yeah, that's well said. Now, you also had taught something else when you were the president of Southeastern University. I always remember this. You had a big statue put up with the disciples washing Jesus' feet, and you called it servant leadership. Explain to the audience what you meant by that.
Yeah, we put that statue, a more than life-size statue of Jesus washing the disciples' feet, and I put it right in the center of the campus because I wanted the students, no matter what building they were going to, dorm, building, anything, even to eat, I wanted them to walk in front of that the most powerful, most famous, most anointed man in the whole world washed feet. That when you serve, that's the reason our ministry is called Global Servants. When you serve, you don't lose authority. You are not powerless. You're not broken in serving. You are actually demonstrating Christ-like leadership. It's like a man who cares for his children. He is serving them, but he's not in subservience to them. They obey him. He's in authority, but he doesn't have to pound his chest like a gorilla to be obeyed. The true servant leader cares for the people that he leads, just as Jesus cared for the people he leads. And I believe it's fundamental. If they can get that, if they can just get servant leadership, that does away with entitlement, you see, doesn't it?
Yes.
Because I don't deserve, I don't want what I deserve. If I get what I deserve, I'm doomed. I want grace, I want to work, I want to earn, and I want to serve. And that's the key to great leadership, is great servanthood.
Now, let me ask you another question. A lot of these kids don't understand about student loans and student debt. What advice do you have for these kids that are going to school? Because you were the president of two universities. What type of majors should they pick if they're going to get student loans? What type of payback should they expect? How are they planning? Because we have over $1 trillion in student loans now with these kids. And a lot of them, and many of them, you know, a huge percentage is now in default because they simply can't make the payments, can't bankrupt the payments anymore because of, you know, laws were passed back in the 70s. What advice do you have for children that are listening right now who are planning on going to college or university, Pastor, having been the president of two universities? What do you want to tell them about student loans?
All right, three things. The first thing is this. I'm a very unconventional college president. I don't believe everybody needs to go to college.
I think that's good.
I think it is a key. I think it's important depending on the field you want to be in. But if you want to be a pipe fitter, why spend 4 years borrowing money to major in psychology and then go to trade school to become a pipe fitter? Skip the psychology degree. And so I would say not everybody needs to go to college. Second, if you're going to go to college, don't choose a major like Eastern European basket weaving. Choose something that has some potential for return on your investment.
That's right.
And the third thing is this. A lot of these student loans are not necessary. I know it was a long time ago. I understand that. Things have changed a lot. But my wife and I, we have 5 degrees between us. We both have a bachelor's degree. We both have a master's degree. And I have a PhD. And we never borrowed a dime, ever. We worked. I worked. I bagged groceries at an all-night grocery store. I'd sleep 2 hours. I'd get up and drive a school bus. I'd go to school. I'd go home in the afternoon and go work at an apartment complex, cleaning out filthy apartments where people had lived. I'd drive the afternoon school bus. I'd do my studies. Then I'd go to the grocery store and bag groceries till 3 in the morning. We both did that. We worked like dogs. And you can do it. I'm not saying it's easy, but you can do it. Now, one other thing, and that is this. Sometimes there is a rational reason to borrow money to go to school. It is a way, it's like leveraging your business. You leverage forward in order to expand your restaurant, to put up more tables, to hire more so that you can increase your profit margin. I understand business leverage, but it needs to be done carefully, taking into account what the possibility is for your payback, and a reasonable payment schedule that you can get that student debt out of the way and get on with the rest of your life. But it is not essential. Now, you can go to a school, you can go to a junior college, you can work your way through and do it. If you have to work one summer, go a semester, take the next semester off. There's no race. The battle is not to the swift, not to the strong, nor the race to the swift. Chip away at it. Be reasonable. Better to graduate 3 years after everybody else. When they're paying their student debt off, you'll be driving a new car.
That's true. Well, you know, I tell people this. If you're going to go get a professional degree, if you're going to be an engineer, yes, or a doctor or a nurse or an, yes, attorney or something that you can get a license and be licensed with the state and charge more than, you know, minimum wage for your time, you know, you have an ability to pay back the student loan, then it's like you said, you leverage it out against the future. But the reality is a lot of people, probably over 80% of the students who get degrees in Eastern European basket weaving, never use the degree, but they end up with $100,000 in debt from that degree, and yes, nobody wants to hire them because they're not hireable because they don't have a functional degree. And I see this over and over and over and over again. What I did with Harrison, as you know, Austin graduated with his bachelor's degree and his master's from Southeastern University. My daughter Alexis now is in her freshman year at Southeastern University. This is Pastor Rutland's his first college gig when he was a president. And what happened, you know, with Harrison, my youngest son, he went in dual enrollment in the collegiate high school program at the local junior college and finished his bachelor's degree there, pretty much completely paid for by the state. Now he's getting a master's degree at Florida State University. It's costing him a little bit, but I'm helping him with that because he cost me basically nothing as an undergraduate. So if you have a child that's capable of starting in college while they're in high school, and they can become part of the collegiate high school program and get all of that done for free. When Harrison, yes, graduated from high school, he graduated from high school he already completed his junior year of college. He's taking senior classes in his senior year of high school. In fact, they had to change the rules for the state of Florida to allow him to do that, and made a one-time chance for him to do that because no one had ever done that before. Because that's the way the system needs to be used. Because if you're already paying all these school taxes through your property taxes, you might as well let them pay for your bachelor's degree. That's what I always tell kids, if they're smart enough and mature enough to start a program like that. So it's just so important. Now, Pastor, tell me about your latest book and how can people get copies of that?
Good. The latest book has just taken off like a shot. I'm absolutely thrilled with this book. It's David the Great. It is a story about the life. It's called, the subtitle is Deconstructing the Man After God's Own Heart. It's the life and leadership of King David. It's this is not your Sunday school version of King David. This is not the curly-headed little boy with the slingshot. This is the grit and grime behind the scenes, the real deal. And it's just exploded, Ted. I'm really thrilled with this book.
Well, tell me a little bit about the plot on it. Tell me a little bit about who's your publisher. Where can they get the book? Is it on Amazon? Is it in bookstores? How can they get the book?
Any place you can get books, you can get David the Great by Mark Rutland. Amazon, bookstores. You can go to davidthegreatbook.com. And this it deals with the life lessons, the good and the bad. David was a Bronze Age Jewish warlord who was a multifaceted genius. He was a poet, a musician, a warrior. He was a consummate politician. He founded a new capital. He's the founder of Jerusalem. This is 3,000 years ago. It's right at the end of the Bronze Age. The first iron weapon mentioned in the Bible is the head of Goliath's spear, was mentioned as being iron. And they wouldn't mention it unless the technology was that new. And he was a genius, and yet deeply flawed. He committed adultery and conspiracy and murder. And yet at the end of everything, not once but twice, once in the Old Testament and once in the New Testament, he is called the man after God's own heart. And I just said, I want to understand this. How can this complex genius, this deeply conflicted man, be called a man after God's own heart? And that's what the book is about. What makes him a great leader? What made him a great king? What can we learn from him? What can we learn from his mistakes? Why do we have to make all the same mistakes? Why can't we learn from his disasters? And it's really been a book that hit with males. That's one thing I was really happy about. Two audiences that it's hard to get to buy books are millennials and males, and we hit with both audiences. Millennials want it because it's practical, it's down to earth, it's straightforward. They don't want any baloney. They don't want that. They want it straight out. And this is straight out. And with men, David was a man's man, wasn't he?
I mean,
this is a guy you want to take deer hunting with you.
That's right.
You might not want him to take your wife deer hunting, but he's a tough guy. He was a warrior's warrior. It's one lady bought 10 cases. That's 160 books. And I said, "Ma'am, I'm happy for you to have them. It thrills me." "Why?" She said, "My son's a master sergeant. I'm buying a book for every man in his unit." Another guy bought them for all the police in his town. He said he bought for every one of the city cops. It's really been that kind of book. I'm just so pleased with it.
Now, also, let me ask you another question. How can we get in touch with Global Servants? How can we give money to that organization with these homes in Thailand and in Africa? How can people support your ministry, Pastor?
Thank you, Ted. You've been so gracious through the years personally and so generous, and being generous now with your own people. Yes, globalservants.org is our website. I hope they'll go there, learn all they want, reach out to us. We're happy to answer any questions. We're very straightforward, and they can contribute right there online or any way they want. We will make sure that we find a way to help them make any contribution they want, and it means so much. We handle every dollar with discretion and with integrity, and it means so much that you've endorsed us like this. I really appreciate it, Ted.
Well, I'll go one notch further. If you buy the book, David the Great, by Mark Rutland, and you don't like it, send it to me, and I'll refund your money. And I'll give it to somebody else who wants to read it and who will enjoy it. But that's how – I can't endorse it any more than that, Pastor. I mean, I will personally refund the money to them if they get the book and it's not everything you say it is. Now, I've read portions of the book. It was phenomenal. Haven't read it all yet. But I tell you what, guys, this is a really good read. It'll teach your boys how to get machoed up a little bit, who David really was. And we have a real problem with the millennials being kind of, how should I say this in a nice way, sissified because of all the hormones in the food supply and not having proper parental boundaries given to them by their dads, who in many cases are non-existent, they're gone. So this is one of those books, like the military lady who basically bought it for her son for the entire platoon or squadron of men who wanted to read the book. So guys, that's as strong as I can make an endorsement for a book. I don't think Mark's had anyone else who's promoted the book for him who have told people they will buy it back from them at retail. Because I will, but I, and you guys all know me, you know that I will do that if you send it back to me. That's how much I want you to get a copy of this book, and I want you to support Global Servants. Mark, we got a couple minutes left. Go ahead. What do you want to say in closing?
Well, one thing about the book, it may not be important to your people to hear it, but I need to say it. I do not take one penny from any of the 17 books I've ever published. It all goes 100% to Global Servants and to our girls' homes. So every book they buy is the same thing as a contribution to the girls' homes. What God has allowed me to do in my lifetime has been an honor. I feel honored to serve these little girls, to buy them shoes, to pay for their meals, to take them to get them to college, to serve these remote villages. It's an honor to me to build a toilet in a remote village in West Africa. I don't feel put down by that. I feel honored, and I'm blessed to take part in it. And we have 350 students in our school, an elementary school in Ghana. We have built clinics, we've dug wells, I don't consider it a sacrifice or a burden or anything else. It's been the honor of my life, and I'm grateful.
Pastor, how much does it cost to build a well, or to dig a well?
It's to build a well is about $5,000. The toilet would be more like it's multifaceted, so a toilet, it's like four toilets on a concrete platform. It's a very much more sophisticated operation than I can describe. That's about $2,000.
Okay, and how about to sponsor a girl in Thailand, or do you allow individual sponsorships?
Yes,
for girls?
We do. We do have individual sponsorship, and we would love to. We bring in new girls every spring, and it's about. I think it's $70 a month. I believe they can find that online. I should have had that information right in front of me. But yes, we love child sponsors, and we do not multi-sponsor a girl. By the way, I know a lot of ministries do that, and I don't. It's up to them. But if we tell you you're sponsoring that girl, you are sponsoring that girl. We're not sending out the same picture to 20 different families.
Well, I've seen a lot of ministries do that. Yes. That's why I've warned my listeners to just avoid the TV stuff and just give the local churches. And now, with you being the exception, you're the only one I've ever brought on to do this because, I mean, you're it. Because I've known you for so many years, and I know your fruit. And I know your character. I think you wrote it and had another book that you really emphasized that character matters. And it really, really does. You've got to do what you say you're going to do. And Mark Rutland is the man that does and says it all lines up together. And he's a man of integrity and a man of his word. He always does what he says he's going to do. And I love that about him. Okay, anything else you want to close with, Pastor? We got about 2 minutes.
Well, I just want to say that I believe that this is a crucial generation, that right now we're facing politically, geopolitically, globally. This is one of the most strenuous, complicated times in world history. And I believe that right now we need to be on our guard, praying, seeking God, and doing everything we can possibly do to see that the right is advanced and the wrong is turned away. This is an intersection of history, Ted.
It is. I agree with you, Pastor, because if we don't, especially with these elections coming up next week,
yes.
I mean, like on your birthday.
Yes.
I mean, it's one of those things that just is really a major, major deal that my listeners understand. But because the mainstream media has done such an excellent job at dumbing everybody down, the vast majority of the people in the United States still don't get where we are as far as the crossroads between socialism, between the Republic of the United States. You know, and of course, socialism is just a fancy word for communism. And we don't need to follow what Lenin and Marx and Stalin did in Russia and in Europe. I mean, the whole Iron Curtain fell across Europe, you know, after World War II, and it became a complete nightmare for all the people who were over there. And then Stalin killing tens of millions of his own people, primarily Christians, by the way. We don't need to allow that to happen to the United States and be brought into some type of dictatorship here with these crazy crazies running around. Now, real quick question for you, Pastor. You've been the president of two universities. Any interest in being a president of another university? Or are you done with that chapter in your life?
That chapter's closed. I had a great time. I don't regret it, but I've moved on, and now I'm traveling, speaking, writing, lecturing. The National Institute of Christian Leadership that I teach has exploded. We have hundreds of students in that, and I'm just enjoying this phase of my life. I'm happy I did those two universities, but that chapter's closed.
Tell me about this institute you have for leadership. What is that?
Yeah, people can look that up, thenicl.com. I urge, it's largely pointed toward pastors, but we have business people and others come through it. But I would urge every listener, make sure your pastor attends. You can go to thenicl.com, and I hope that they will look it up and pay your pastor's way to come to the NICL. It's a down-to-earth, practical, hands-on, the leadership and values that can make a church great in the 21st century.
Pastor Mark Rutland, thank you for being my guest today. Thanks everybody for contributing to Pastor Rutland's ministry. Thank you today for listening. Guys, I want to thank you for supporting Health Masters. I want to thank you for helping me get through this week with Austin being away and having multiple guests on the show, including Pastor Rutland. And I want to thank you guys for supporting our company. I want to thank you for getting your vitamins from us. I want to thank you for the way you continue to bless us in all the areas of our life, and that you guys are some faithful prayer warriors. I had a dear friend yesterday, Terry, called me up or text me and says, I'm at my sister's house right now. What can I pray for you? I've got some extra time in the afternoon. So I gave her a list of things to pray for, including you, my listeners, which I had a chance to pray for again this morning. I want you to know from the deepest parts of my heart, I greatly appreciate everything you've done for me. I thank you for getting your multiple vitamins again from us again, and for getting your other nutritional products from us. If it wasn't for you and what you do for me and for healthmasters.com, I could never bring you programming like we did today, which was basically a heartfelt message from Pastor Mark Rutland letting you guys know that you can make a difference in Thailand and in Africa, and that working together that we can all do all that we can do all things through Christ who strengthens us. Because guys, if we don't work together as a team right now, and I talked to J.B. Wells about this today, I texted him and I said, we have to have a synergistic movement right now. We have to all work together to save this country, save the Republic, and save the planet from what's going on all around us. God bless you guys. Have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. I will talk to you on Monday. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. God bless.